It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
This week marked the end of an era as President Barack Obama gave his farewell address to thousands in Chicago. But what is his legacy, especially for the Democratic Party? Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. He was the first African-American to ascend to the White House, and he brought a sense of hope and change, the campaign slogan often heard in 2008. His soaring rhetoric of aspiration this week contrasted itself to the pugnacious businessman who will succeed him, Donald Trump. There are accomplishments ranging from pulling the nation out of the Great Recession, the Affordable Care Act, to the Paris Climate Accords and gay marriage. But for Democrats, his soaring rhetoric could not save them. His tenure saw a Republican wave not only on Capitol Hill, but the governorships and state houses across the country. And he's being succeeded by a man who once questioned his birth certificate and promised to end what has become called Obamacare. In 2016, Democrats also saw a struggle within their own ranks. With the rise of Bernie Sanders' presidential candidacy, they mounted a strong challenge to the more centrist Hillary Clinton. So even as the Democrats grapple with their own losses, they may well be struggling with who they are as a party. In our studio this morning, we have Billy Earl Amos. He's the incoming president of Wicomico County Democratic Club. Also, Salisbury University political science professor Michael Laughlin. Welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning. Good to be here.
So, Billy, I want to start with you since you're the party guy.
Okay.
What, as a party, what do you think Obama's legacy is?
It's going to be a mixed bag. On one hand, it's admirable, and it was a terrific achievement in creating Obamacare. The rollout and the public relations of it, though, will ultimately be considered the massive failure. On the other hand, his role in the party has been a disappointing one. He had an opportunity, I think, to be the FDR of our time. But unfortunately, the economic policies subsequent to the crash didn't speak to enough Americans in a significant enough way. And I think, unfortunately, that's going to be his legacy. The chance was there, but a true centrist did not take those opportunities.
Michael, what about you? How do you see his legacy?
Well, I think we have to remember that the legacy of a presidency is not simply the consequence of a president's intentions or actions, but it's a consequence of the interaction between the presidency on the one hand and the Congress that he has to work with and the overall political context. And in that light, I do echo Billy's first sense that Obama took on a enormous recession. Led into at least economic stability. I mean, we have an unemployment rate now of under 5%, and Obama does not get enough credit, I think, for getting us out of that enormous recession, that deep recession, and into economic stability. Unfortunately, the political system did not address, however, the class inequalities that fundamentally remain a structural feature of our society. Just last week, I think the Washington Post reported some enormous gains for the upper 10%, where middle class and working class Americans remain, their wages remain stagnant, incomes remain stagnant. And that, of course, fed into the consequence of this election. With regard to the healthcare policy, there was, I think, a moment lost there where it's becoming clear that the problems, there have been significant advances with the Obamacare with regard to the question of pre-existing conditions. That is going to continue to be an important advance for the health care of Americans. And, of course, insurance for our children remaining on their parents' policies till the age 26. That is going to remain a legacy. Republicans aren't going to get rid of either one of those. However, on the other hand, it remains the case that while there are advances in health care insurance coverage, we don't have universal health care insurance. So the moment was lost to get perhaps a national health care, universal health care insurance earlier under basically an expanded Medicare program.
Let me pose the question this way, because the sense I get, and particularly as we saw the 2016 election unfold, the thing that seemed to represent
for Hillary Clinton was basically sort of a Democratic Leadership Council approach. That was a much more conservative approach that came out of the 1980s. Bill Clinton was part of that. Obama seemed to embrace some of that, and but more importantly, the Democratic Party seemed to embrace that, whether it was, for instance, with health care as a particularly as a good example, in which the Democratic Party found itself almost absolutely impossible to get the 60 votes needed to get this thing passed. I mean, it dragged on in part because of Democrats. Billy, what about, are there two visions here within the Democratic Party that we're seeing?
Well, I think there are. In fact, I'm going to say something that probably is anathema to most Democrats. But I think one of the genius elements of Bill Clinton was that he took the Democratic Party and taught it to run like Republicans. When this messaging issue came up, and let's assume arguendo that the Democratic Party is looking at this race several years ago, and they're looking at the reality of who should be the candidate. Because of the internal relationship dynamics within the party, I think that there was a strategic error made. And that strategic error was making the assumption that Hillary was going to be the candidate and would be the best chance. I don't think ultimately history will judge it that way. Now, Gordon Wood, the great historian, says that it's a fool's errand to be looking at it now, because if we were looking at Harry Truman in 1952, we never could have foreseen how he looks 20 years later. But I think that the weakness in the Democratic Party was not realizing that a new message, a new messenger, primarily an economic focus, was needed, and they needed to go with their best card, and I don't think they did that.
Michael, what about that idea? And where do you see Obama fitting into that scale, as it were, between DLC on the one hand and, I assume, would basically sort of a Bernie Sanders wing on the other?
Perhaps one way to put it is, in ideological terms, I think Obama was and is a liberal Democrat, whereas Bernie Sanders is a social right. Democrat. And I think that Obama was comfortable taking on essentially a corporate liberal role in trying to steer. I mean, we have to remember that Obamacare was fashioned after Mitt Romney's plan in Massachusetts. So he adopted a kind of moderate Republican plan. And was able, and the Democratic Party, the leadership, the elite leadership of the party, grabbed a hold of that and pushed that through, rather than embracing essentially a Medicare for all health care insurance program, which is a social democratic proposal, which is the one that Bernie Sanders has been trumpeting and certainly in the recent campaign. So, and I think that therefore accounts for part of the loss, but part of the advances as well. And so I think the war within the Democratic Party is going to be between the corporate liberal segment and the social democratic segment that I think is now more empowered because of this loss than it was previously.
Well, part of it I'm wondering about, and we've placed a lot of emphasis on the president, but, you know, during his term, around 900 state legislative seats were lost to the Republicans. 35 state legislative chambers flipped to Republicans. This is where, Billy, this is, and you know this well because you've been in the trenches. These are the places, this is the farm teams. Mm-hmm. This is where these people come out of in order to run for national office. Now, I am reminded, by the way, that in past years, there are other parties, for instance, the Republican Party has major losses. George W. Bush lost 7 governors, 9 Senate seats, 42 House seats, 324 legislative seats, 13 legislative seats. So this is not an impossible hurdle. But what do you think your party is doing wrong and not energizing that base to, one, capture certainly the state houses and the state governments, which are going to be really important a few years from now because of redistricting? And how does that fit into what we see in terms of trying to get a national figure?
Okay. There's a quote from the president that will live forever, and that is, we don't do theater. Politics is theater. When the Obamacare was being fashioned, there simply was not a message that was clear regarding how important the public option would be to this. It was part of the discussion, but it wasn't as frontal as it needed to be. In fact, there are many things about his presidency where the theater simply didn't come up to the standard that needs to take place so that people in Bishopville, Maryland, can look at this and say, well, okay, I get it. I see what we're doing, and I support it. That didn't happen.
Is there a lack, though, of hands-on? That is, he came in, and as a matter of fact, they were sort of the avant-garde in terms of computerization and the internet and social media and all that kind of thing. They had almost sort of huge organization, but the Democrats didn't seem to take advantage of that.
No, they didn't. And what they did, there were many of the campaign aspects that relied on technology and relied on the digital world, when what should have been happening was there should have been a precinct leader in every precinct in America. That precinct leader should have been talking to everybody on the block so that when it came time to vote, when it came time to organize, when it came time to mobilize, there wasn't a robocall from someplace in Chicago. There wasn't an email from some innocuous source. There was actual people talking to other actual people about issues that were important. That was a failure on the part of this administration.
Michael, do you think that failure was reflected in the Sanders campaign? The fact that it almost produced the Sanders campaign?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've always maintained the proposition that I think Occupy Wall Street produced the Sanders phenomenon. And the phenomenon was based on the appeal to class questions. That is, the question of income inequality, wealth inequality, working class people across races, across gender. And what I think what happened to the Democrats, and I think that a lot of we in the media or in the academia, I should say, fell victim to this as well. The assumption that, well, look, on all these social liberal issues, gay marriage and so on, these great advances, this diversity of women plus African Americans plus Latino Americans, that this coalition, and the assumption was that working class people would just come along just automatically. Yeah. And surprise, surprise. I mean, there are a lot of reasons why Clinton lost this election, but one of them clearly is the economic question, and the Democrats have failed. I mean, failed miserably, and I agree with Billy that the big turn was Bill Clinton. Ironically, Bill Clinton leads, I think, to the loss of Hillary Clinton because of the shift towards, we're going to go after where the money is, we're going to go after a corporate liberal vision, and working class people, well, we'll address them a little bit, but we're not going to pay very close attention to them. So that's why I think that there is a chance now for the Democratic Party to go back to its roots within the New Deal period. I mean, we don't have to come that necessarily social Democrats. We need to just look to that kind of era to reinvigorate the connection between the Democratic Party and working class Americans.
Well, that brings me to the idea about this almost a clash, certainly in this election, between, on the one hand, what was considered the ascendant majority, was that African Americans, Hispanics particularly, as opposed to, say, what is becoming a white minority. I want to go to a clip that Barack Obama has of where he talks in his farewell speech about this dichotomy.
I'm here to insist that we are not as divided as we seem. And I know that because I know America. I know how we've come against impossible odds. I know we'll make it because of what I've experienced in my own life, what I've seen of this country and its people, their goodness and decency as President of the United States.
And basically what he's saying, in essence, is that here's a situation where he's thinking, on the one hand, about you have to understand how people feel on the other side of this line that divides these two segments. That on the one hand, you've got to say, okay, you have to understand how African Americans feel, minorities feel, but on the other hand, you have to also understand how white voter feels. Is there a division there within the Democratic Party and within the country in general, or is it something that the Democratic Party can reach out to?
It is something that they can reach out to, but there is that division. Just as an example, I've had it said to me here in when I lived in Worcester County that you could not be a Democrat and a Christian at the same time. Now, I think that's a remarkably divisive statement, but this is also said to me from somebody that I've played music with and somebody that I've broken bread with, and I have a lot in common. But when we're talking about division, I think we're talking about the way people look at politics. I am actually at a complete loss to explain how a working class American can look at Donald Trump and say, yeah, that's the guy that's going to help me. There's nothing in his background, nothing in his history that even suggests that he would have that kind of bent. And let's be frank, the presidency of the United States really shouldn't be an entry-level job. There are things, the long knives are already coming out in Washington, and they're coming out from both sides, because I've never seen anybody who has insulted as many people as this guy has. Now, Barack Obama didn't do that when he came in. I thought that he saw the protocol for a new incoming president, and he looked at that strategically and tactically and said, okay, I've got all of this on my plate. What do I do first? If he had really dug down deep on Obamacare and done some things differently, we could be looking at a completely different ballgame, but that didn't happen. That message didn't occur. The ensuing problem was this long and very deep divisiveness. And it results in people who benefit from Obamacare because they don't really understand. They don't understand the Medicaid expansion, so they may very well have been tremendously benefited, but they still take umbrage at the fact that the federal government now is involved in their health care.
What about this divide? I mean, because a lot of attention has been paid to the idea that the Democrats didn't pay as much attention to the white working class. Although I'm reminded of populist movements in the past, certainly in the late 1800s, a populist movement that grew up then, and in the South, that populist movement certainly was divided on the basis of race, and that was how it was one of the reasons why it collapsed. Is this coalition viable, or are we going to continue to see this division play out, perhaps in an echo of that 18th century, 19th century?
I want to suggest that I think that the racial divide has an independent dynamic to it, as well as an interdependent dynamic with the class question, the question of inequality of wealth and income. And I think part of the answer to your question as to what the future holds is to what extent the political system as a whole, and particularly the Democrats, can in fact really turn their attention more effectively to addressing white working class concerns and anxieties and real desperation with regard to the income question. And that if that is addressed, then the possibility of essentially building a bridge over this racial divide, I think can be mended. I mean, we have to remember, I just remember seeing some of the interviews with some folks, some white working class people in Michigan, who said that they voted for Obama in 08, and they voted for him again in 12. But they voted for Trump this time around. So they were clearly willing to vote for the first African-American president, not once, but twice. But their economic concerns were getting worse, or they were stagnating, and they were going to say, the hell with the Democrats. I'm going to go for this crazy, pugnacious businessman, Donald Trump, even though, as I agree completely with Billy Earle, the guy has no experience. I mean, Goldman Sachs seems to be his favorite place to hire people for his White House and government.
So Billy, are we going to see a continuing conflict within the party between white working class as opposed to the ascendant majority? Or are we looking at, as a matter of fact, in the speech, one of the things that Obama mentioned was the idea that white working class has got to get used to the idea of this emerging majority, because more and more workers are going to be brown when it comes to their skin. There's a warning. You want, Mike?
Yeah, very quickly. But see, if they don't address the economic question, the brown and black working class folks, there's going to be a division.
Same thing.
There. Hmm. I mean, so it's not as if the Democrats can just ride this steed of this growing majority-minority demographic and not worry about white working class. If they don't worry about working class people, that will then weaken their own majority-minority of Latinos and African-Americans. I mean, if African-American white working-class folks are not going to be advancing, I mean, they're in worse shape than many of the white working-class folks. So, and I mean, you know, Clinton didn't get as many African-American votes. Why is that?
So what about that? Is it going to be continuing?
I think it's not only going to be continuing, but in some ways, what it's going to speak to is in this election, Obama was kind of the third guy out. He was the foil for many of these arguments because they were making the argument that America was unfair to a certain number of people in terms of job opportunities and the economy. If you look at the United States in comparison to other mature economies around the world, we're theoretically doing just fine, but there's a whole class of people that are being left behind, and most of it is educationally. Now, in the classic statement that Hillary Clinton made about coal people, what she was talking about was providing education to coal miners and allowing them to go into other fields. That's not the way it came out. That got spun into a completely different, we're going to decimate the coal industry and all these people are going to be hurt. Long story short, the messaging on this to these people has to be real. Now, we saw in this election, that's not really what was said or done. In fact, many of these grandiose claims that were made by the Republican candidate are nothing more than, I'm going to do better. I'm going to do it great. I'm going to give you health care that's much better and much cheaper. Well, there's a question that's looming in that, and that is how. How are you going to do that? The American public didn't really care to know how. What they wanted was theater. They wanted somebody to act as a cheerleader. That's not going to work long term. And I think what's going to happen in this cycle, if this president is not impeached and he does continue and he's simply ineffective, what's going to happen is the Democratic Party has to come up with a clear and messageable plan of how we're going to change this and how we're going to benefit Americans. And if they don't do that, then we sit in this hole for a longer period of time.
Let me ask you this. In terms, because one of the things that seems to me to undergird this thing is globalization, because we're talking a lot about it. And the globalization is symbolized by free trade. And certainly the Republicans have been free trade until just a few months ago, where now they're talking about, well, maybe we need to roll it back under the Trump campaign. Do we expect this globalization to continue to roil this particular, your party, but parties in general, because we've seen a lot of that in Europe as well. It's been also upended a lot, but the Brexit vote, for instance, for Britain to leave the European Union. Is that going to continue, do you think? And how do the parties, and particularly the Democratic Party, try to deal with that? You first, Mike.
Absolutely. I think that the globalization essentially is a capitalism gone wild. that corporations are multinational now, so that there's no question, and there's no escaping. There's no movement back to an isolationist, independent America. And so the impact of that, of course, is to push down wages, to push in the direction of the cheapest labor wherever corporate America can find it, or wherever a European capital can find it, or Japanese capital, or Chinese capital, for that matter. So that the pressure, I think, is going to be continuing pressure for certainly Democrats. So how do they respond to that? And I think Bernie Sanders again has led a charge where it's basically saying, well, what we need to do is to pressure the other countries, in effect, to have stronger environmental regulations, stronger labor protection regulations. And what that means is to increase the cost of labor in other places so that American labor is not priced out of the marketplace in that respect. And in this respect, this is where I think the ideology is a clear piece of this, that so many of these white working class people, by voting for Donald Trump, they think that this capitalist, corporate capitalist, is going to be working on their behalf, but he's against labor unions. He's against increasing the minimum wage. So the Democrats perhaps will be provided in the next few years with some opening there to be pushing in the direction of more rights for workers, that meaning stronger unions, not weaker unions, increases in the minimum wage, increases in regulations, both here with regard to the environment and labor protections, but also internationally as well.
Billy, are the centrist Democrats going to go along with that? Centrist Democrats have supported free trade agreements, such as the current president.
That's a great question. One of the fallacies that we're looking at in this trade issue is that much of the outsourcing of American products has been done because of labor savings. As we move forward in the future, there's going to be a dynamic shift in our economy from things that were done by people to things that are done by robots. Two perfect examples are the auto industry and the way that Ford is moving this this big place back to Michigan. That's going to be a robotized environment. You're going to see it in an area where white middle class men work as much as in any other thing that they do, and that's driving a vehicle. Those are going to be robotized. Those are going to be self-driving cars. The American public needs something else. Now, this is the perfect place for Democrats to come in and to solve the problem by education. If we're going to spend $600 billion a year on defense, we need to spend an equal amount to allow people to get into colleges without saddling them with these massive debts. One of the things that Bernie Sanders ran on was a shift in the economic equivalency for education. But until Democrats look at issues like this in the larger picture, we're chasing our own tail, I think.
We've been speaking with Billy Earl Amos. He's the incoming president of the Wicomico County Democratic Club, also Salisbury University political science professor Michael Laughlin. Appreciate you guys stopping by and talking with us.
So much.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. Also, we want to mention that we will be airing Mark Steiner's Annapolis Summit this afternoon at 1 p.m. on WSDL 90.7 FM, featuring Governor Larry Hogan, House Speaker Michael Bush, and Senate President Mike Miller. That's this afternoon, 1 p.m. on WSDL 90.7 FM. I'm Don Rush. This has been Delmarva Today. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Stephanie Fowler.
And this is Tony Russo.
And this week on So What's Your Story, we are talking with Gail Priest, author of the Annie Crow Knoll series.
Join us Saturdays, 1 p.m. after This American Life on WSDL, Rhythm and News. Stephanie never says Rhythm and News.
Not all the time.
This is Tom Pittman, and I hope you can join me this Friday evening at 8 for some vintage country music. This will be our Friday the 13th edition. At the top of the second hour, we'll be featuring the top 10 for the year 1961, and it is a particularly good one. Join us here on WSDL.
Could the city of Salisbury be in for a major makeover? Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Plans are now underway for a major urban greenway that would run from Shoemaker Pond to Pemberton Park. It is part of plans set in motion by Mayor Jake Day as he attempts to do what many have not, reshape the crossroads of Delmarva. He says the concept has been around since the 1960s, but it has never been carried out. His plans to submit a funding proposal to the City Council next week. But it is also part of a larger plan for revitalization of downtown areas, as well as looking at ways to reshape Route 13, is currently lined with various strip malls and individual shops. And we have the mayor in our studio this morning. Thank you for coming by.
Thank you, Don.
So, well, tell me a little bit about the origin of this, of the Greenway. I indicated a moment ago that the idea has sort of been actually around for a very long time.
Yeah. There are a couple of plans that you can reflect on that our city has adopted or invested in over the years where you can see kind of great ideas and visions that were thought of, conceptualized, but not implemented. One of them is the 1965 Plan for Growth for Salisbury and Wicomico County, which says you need to buy large swaths of downtown Salisbury. You need to tear the buildings down. You need to turn them into parking lots for 5 years, and you need to develop them into mixed-use development by 1970. And you can see what we did with those. now we have every single parking lot in downtown Salisbury, every single large parking lot in downtown Salisbury, and vacant piece of land, including our marina, under contract or under a land disposition contract with a developer. And now our urban greenway, there are plans from the 60s, the 70s, all the way through our hiker-biker master plan adopted in 2011, which shows essentially a green band drawn with the biggest, fattest green marker that anybody could find. So it lacks all specificity, but, you know, a connection between Pemberton Park and Shoemaker Pond. And that is essentially what we're talking about. An east-west connection through the city that links neighborhoods on each side and also allows people access to the rural kind of recreational opportunities, whether it's biking or hiking or just you know, rural areas, access to rural areas, or specifically access to parks and waterfronts, in the case of Pemberton Historical Park or Shoemaker Park or the Ward Museum, linking those through the core, along the riverfront, along our park, along our zoo. And this plan provides specificity. So now we have it broken into a plan that actually gets all the way down to, here's what we think your engineering costs are going to be. Here's what it's going to cost for the gravel you'll need. Here's what it's going to cost for the crusher run. Here's what it's going to cost for the mulch, the street light, the bench, the trash can, you name it, all the way down to the detail. So that all I've had to do now is plug it right into our fiscal year 18 to 22 capital improvement plan, which is going to the city council on Tuesday.
Well, let me ask you this, because the idea for Greenways for America, I guess it was written by Charles Little, right? This linear concept of space. Tell me a little bit about the history, because I know you've been involved with planning for a long time. And what is the benefit of this? I mean, where's the origin of this thing?
Sure. We recognize that in America, waterfront, let's start there, has been viewed in a variety of ways. At times, it was a dumping ground. It was a back of house. It was a utility. It was a way to get rid of things you didn't want. So whether that was sewage, whether that was trash, whether that was industrial externalities and waste, that you would put it in the water and you would let it flow away and you wouldn't worry about it because then it's gone and it's not your problem anymore. And at other times, it's been incredibly useful as an industrial asset. We need the water to run the mill. You know, we need water to float as the most affordable mode of transport to float our goods to another place and to market. And in the last couple of decades, we also recognize, wow, what a tremendous recreational asset. What a beautiful thing to look at. What a great place to put housing and shops along. And so in America, you've seen a revitalization of waterfronts. From Buffalo, New York, to Oklahoma City, to Indianapolis and Providence. And, of course, everybody, you know, has to mention San Antonio.
Right, of course.
And, you know, nobody can talk about riverwalks or waterfronts without talking about San Antonio. And it's such an interesting place. I mean, let's not forget, it's also the fifth largest city in America. So, you know, people think about, oh, this little town, San Antonio, everybody else should be able to do the exact same thing. Well, they've got 1.5 million people within a, you know, 25 square mile radius.
Right.
So, you know, I don't think we're quite San Antonio, nor will we ever be. But there's a lot of good that we can do that builds on the same precept. And that precept is that, you know, that the idea, the value there is that water is beautiful. It's attractive. It lends value to the properties that face it. Additional value to the properties that face it. And rather than treating it as back of house, as we have long done, that's front of house. So we have to reorient ourselves toward the water. And so an urban greenway says that as best as you can, that should become public space. So it shouldn't just be, you know, I build my house upon the waterfront and this is my little patch of the earth, but rather as many people as we can align along it and can access it and benefit from it, more people in the community will enjoy their experience of being in Salisbury, either living here, visiting here, working here, shopping here. And the best way to do that is to orient the public space laterally along the river. So rather than say, we'll give you opportunities to access the river and to see it, you know, in a few parcels, rather we're going to orient the public space right along the riverfront. And it's going to be, in essence, a street, public right-of-way, you know, at times designed specifically for the pedestrian with cyclists on another component, and at other times where cyclists and pedestrians are in the same, sharing the same sort of zone. It'll be a wider space, obviously, in those cases, but sharing the same zone.
So let me turn to the Pemberton part of this thing. What is sure. that? What will that look like?
So the Pemberton Park, let's start all the way out there on the west side. The typology is they've created sort of a cross section, a typical cross section. And as you know, there's fields out there. So the area that we're talking about and the area we're not trying to induce a cost on Wicomico County or anything like this. This is something we would work on in partnership and help and, you know, apply for grants. And, you know, if they don't want to build it, they don't have to. You know, they own the park. But the idea is, again, to link these things. There's a great trail system in there. There's a lot of people that use it to run and walk. And we certainly wouldn't want to introduce a lot of bike traffic if that's something that those who know about historical properties and the management and maintenance of them think should remain outside of it. So we would bring bikes to a certain point and stop them and put them on bike racks. And then you could enjoy the park on foot. But the alignment would be a trail, a stone dust trail like you see in the park, a stone dust trail alongside of the oyster shell road and between that and the allay of trees. So you'd see this kind of softscape trail introduced. It's not a tremendously high cost. In that phase, I think we're talking about total about $600,000 or $700,000 for the trail introduction. And then it would come out to Pemberton Drive and turn along Pemberton Drive and head back toward the city. And that Pemberton Drive corridor, we looked at several alignments. The consultants looked at an alignment that was not at Pemberton Drive, but it was rather at a patchwork of old bridle trails, rights of way that had been secured in the past, community owned property that went through Harbor Point and the wastewater treatment plant and worked its way back to Marine Road. But, you know, there's a lot of adjacencies that are kind of awkward when you do that. You get some beautiful views of the river. If you've never been, you know, by the water in Harbor Point, there's kind of a forest there that you can get some beautiful views of the river. However, the adjacencies would get kind of weird. And I can tell you right now that I think there are people who live in Harbor Point who would not be as amenable to the arrival of a bikeway in their neighborhood right now. But I guarantee you, once they're in place, they're going to wish it was. They're going to wish it was. But the easier corridor is along Pemberton Drive. And so that corridor would be probably a dedicated kind of off-road, so separated probably by a curb, off-road, two-way trail, rather than a bike lane on each side of Pemberton Drive.
So now, as we move eastward, we're going to get into the downtown area. And we've got, for instance, I guess Market Street is going to be a big focus point. And you've got a five-point intersection there. How do you solve that? How do you make that amenable? Because we've talked in the past about the idea that one of the problems with downtown as a whole has been that you get beyond a certain point and then the streets get kind of strange. And it doesn't really encourage you to walk anywhere, even go anywhere.
It becomes an island.
Right, exactly.
You know, in downtown has become an island unto itself. You know, that's created by engineering and transportation planning, but it's something we can solve through engineering and transportation planning and reverse engineer. So as you come down Pemberton Drive, the idea is you'd turn on Elgood and then turn on to Marine and get on to Fitzwater. And so we have a contract that was paid for through a Maryland Bikeways grant designing right now the Fitzwater corridor. So that's already under design. The pedestrian piece of that would go on to the Riverwalk at the River's Edge Apartments, follow the Riverwalk through the Marina Landing development, which is our marina, which is under contract for development now. Then through Brew River, you'd continue to walk along the Riverwalk and all the way back out to the park, and you'd eventually get to West Main Street. The biking piece of it would look very different than it looks today. Picture Fitzwater today, and it is, you know, one lane of travel, two lanes of parking, a center turn lane, very wide lanes. If it weren't for the potholes, you'd be able to drive really fast down Fitzwater Street. So our intent in rebuilding that and redesigning it is that we would push the traffic to the north. There would be on-street parking for the townhomes that are there. They don't really have any alternative, so we would keep their parking there. But this would actually create one lane of travel in each direction and turn lanes where necessary. So just as it is today, without the sort of suicide lane, they call it, center lane. Mm-hmm. And then push to the south a full lane of on-street parking, so not just at the townhomes, but the whole way of on-street parking. Then a set of planters, so essentially a physical divider, and then a dual-directional cycle track. And a cycle track is just, think of it as a two-way street for bikes. So 6 feet and 6 feet for each direction of bikes. So on street, in the current curb-to-curb setup, you would have a two-way bike road set up in the street all the way to the river's side of Fitzwater Street. And that would travel all the way to where West Main turns off of Fitzwater Street. And at that point, it would become shared traffic. So the bike could use full lane. The bike would have to integrate with traffic. We would place the what you see sharrows, the image that the bike shares the road with the cars on the street, and would integrate into traffic. The Main Street project turns the direction of travel on the plaza in the other direction, so headed eastbound. So bikes would continue with traffic into downtown. They would get their own lane, a full bike lane there, and there's traffic parking on both sides, as well as outdoor seating on both sides, intermittently, 45 new parking spaces. And then you'd find yourself at Main and Division in the center of downtown. And at that point, the cyclists would, again, share, but there'd be dual-directional bike traffic, dual-directional automobile traffic. Alternatively, bikes could cross at Mill Street, cross Mill Street, turn onto Market, and then avoid the whole Mill Street intersection at that point. And then there's two options. One, continue on Market Street, or two, go over a new pedestrian bridge where the old Camden Street Bridge was. And that new pedestrian bridge, a new 20-foot wide bridge, would cross the river and would enable them to get onto Carroll Street. And that Carroll Street corridor is also planned for a road diet, meaning it will go from five lanes down to three, down to a center turn lane and one lane of travel in each direction, planters and a cycle track, and even on-street parking. So these huge kind of highways that we built around our downtown will narrow, and more space will be dedicated to the pedestrian and to cars. And Carroll Street was designed as a five-lane road because we anticipated it accommodating and needing to accommodate just to move the vehicles that we had 30 years ago around the core of the city, 35,000 cars a day. It's never crested 9,000 cars a day. So there's no demand for Carroll Street to be as wide as it is. It's illogical that would ever get to that point when you have 17,000 cars a day, 18,000 cars a day on Route 50. Why would Carroll Street need to be designed for 35,000 cars? It doesn't. And once you get below 15 or 17,500 cars a day, you absolutely can't make an argument for having two lanes in each direction. So there's just no need for it. It is over-engineered, over-designed, and it's something that we, for a long time, at the Metropolitan Planning Organization level, which is our federally mandated planning organization, transportation planning organization, have said we need to narrow this. We need to narrow Carroll.
So let me. So then on the other end, we've got the City Park, we've got the War Museum, I guess the Mallard Retirement Home, that sort of thing.
Yes.
So that seems much more natural in terms of an actual linear kind of transportation and pathway.
So picture yourself riding your bike through the cycle track on Carroll Street. You would cross Carroll Street and then turn left onto Pond, and you would eventually get to the City Park at Snow Hill Road. So there would be a sort of nice, safe way for you to get, quiet way for you to get to the City Park. That's one way at grade we can take cyclists across Route 13. Or pedestrians across Route 13. Further down, when you come up the Riverwalk at either side of the river, our intent there is to expand the Route 13 and Main Street intersection, pull the traffic light back so that we are actually creating a larger area where you would stop all traffic in all four directions for 15 seconds or so and allow pedestrians to cross in any direction they wanted. And that's something that you see at like our Main and Division intersection. You see it at our, you see it in big cities now all the time, where they lock the intersection off for 15 seconds for pedestrians to cross in all directions, not just one direction, but all directions, so that there's no question cars should not be impeding on this space and I'm safe to cross the street. So that's something we're working on to get pedestrians across. And part of this plan, this urban greenway plan, proposes a new pedestrian tunnel on the south side of Main Street under Route 13, or under the across Route 13 and under the railroad tracks.
Yeah.
As another piece of this, our bicycle master plan proposes a rail trail, a trail right along the rail corridor all the way from Fruitland to Del Mar. And so a big piece of this interconnectivity is a trail that's going to come in, go over a new pedestrian bridge that is part of the State Highway Route 13 project, which is ongoing right now, and would connect all of these things to a north-south corridor as well, these east-west projects we're talking about. And as you get on the other side of Route 13, you're exactly right. It would look more natural. You'd see the same signage, but you'd have an option. You could stay at the high level of the park on North Park and South Park Drives, where we have an urban greenway space dedicated on the south side, and we will on the north side, or you can go down into the park, and we'll clean up and expand the trails through the city park as well.
So let me ask you this. I know in some of the plans that have been offered up, I think one of the documents, it talked about some comparisons with the Great Allegheny Passage. We have the Morgantown. There's a trail, river trail there. Ohio's spending some money. I'm just wondering how valid those comparisons are, because as you've described it so far, I mean, this sounds like a very complicated. I mean, if I were to go from the west side to the east side, it sounds like a very complicated way. I mean, to get from one point to the other, how valid are those comparisons? Because I mean, if you go, for instance, if you talk about the Great Allegheny Passage, you're talking about scenery. You're not just talking about what we're looking at here in Salisbury.
Right. Well, that's not an urban greenway at all.
Right, exactly.
But I've been to places like Greenville, South Carolina, and I'm sure others have as well, where there's a great city park in the center and there's a lot of riverfront and there's no way to get from one part to another. Asheville, North Carolina is another one. Great parks, great downtown, no way to get along the riverfront. But they're all working on it and they're all doing it in pieces. And so what's interesting is you can go find a mile stretch that's done well signed, you know, well designed, branded, the signing the same, so you can see it as you're running or walking or biking. Oh, there's my next turn, you know. And then you get to a point it just ends right now. But they're planning the next phase. They've got signs about the next phase. The way we would do it is very different. We'd plan it, sign it, brand it the same, but we'd start from the center out. So we're going to start at the center and work our way out. So it's not, you're never going to find a disconnected piece. So it will always remain a connected piece, and we will work our way from the Carroll and Riverwalk pieces to the Fitzwater piece and the City Park and Zoo piece, and then to the Pemberton Drive or the Safe Routes to School and Ward Street piece, and then to the Pemberton Drive and Shoemaker Pond pieces, and ultimately the Pemberton Park piece. So we would work our way from that center out. So you're never kind of running along and you hit the end of a path and wonder what happened and find yourself standing in the middle of traffic. We do not have a very pedestrian-oriented or cyclist-friendly community, I don't think. I mean, I'm grateful that we've done enough that we can get awarded bicycle-friendly city, but we've got a long way to go. And I want to get to a place where somebody can safely maneuver through the infrastructure that we've planned and that we've connected it in such a way that they don't feel like they're hitting a spot where they don't feel safe anymore. I'm very confident that this plan actually creates a connected, linked pathway where they won't have a moment where they say, you know what, this is not safe to traverse. I'm very confident that this plan will alleviate those concerns.
Because one of the arguments that they've made in some of the documents is the idea that this is going to bring tourism. Mm-hmm. Obviously, again, there's some comparisons with Pennsylvania, New Jersey, in terms of either buying hard goods, as they like to say, for bicycling or even just day trips and so on. What would make this particularly a tourist attraction, as mm-hmm. opposed, and understand, of course, you are not only trying to create something to attract people, but you are also then competing with a whole set of other cities around the peninsula. I mean, Ocean City is just one, Berlin's another one. So we're going to invest all this money. Are we going to get, what are we going to get for it? I mean, is that a real good comparison?
Well, let me just say that I don't believe we're competing with Ocean City or Berlin or, you know, Cambridge or Easton or Lewis or Rehoboth. I don't think we're in competition with them at all. I think we're working in partnership with them. When I think about tourism here, yeah, we might get some day trippers. You're right. But I think we're mostly talking about people who are coming on vacation. We are an area where people come on vacation, and they are going to go to the beaches, and they are going to go to some of the bay towns. They are going to go to St. Michael's, and I think that's fantastic. And we remain, you know, the economic hub where people go to shop and people go to work. You know, we have 17,000 workers who live in the city of Salisbury. We have 54,000 jobs. We have we have $350 million of buying power in the city, and we do $1.6 billion in retail sales a year. You know, we are the economic hub. So people are going to come here in their travels if they need something. They are going to come here if they want to work, even if they live elsewhere in the region. This is a place where people are going to come. So that being said, what I want to do is make us an attraction for people to want to stop through as part of their trip. So our competition is truly against those places like Greenville and Asheville and Frederick. We're competing as a region and saying, come to this region and we're going to be a part of the puzzle. We're going to be a piece of that puzzle. And let's not forget, the other piece that we are providing here is not just about tourism, but it's about benefiting the people who live here. You know, people who live and work here, they go to our city park to run in the morning. They go, I see people running downtown at lunch in the early evenings. At the end of the day, you'll see folks walk into, if you sit at Main Roots, you'll see somebody walk in scrubs into a building, go upstairs, change. They come out in running clothes and they start running down the plaza. It happens every single day. So I want to give people an opportunity to do that where they're not just making the best of the environment that they're in, but rather we're giving them the environment that's suited to the activity they want to engage in. And the reality is when people come to a region like the Eastern Shore and Delmarva Peninsula, they're looking to kayak and they're looking to bike and they're looking to stand up paddleboard and they're looking to canoe and they're looking to run. They want to experience the beauty of the Eastern Shore and the beauty of the water. And if we don't give the best treatment to the spaces along those corridors, then I think we're shortchanging ourselves as a place where people want to move to. I hear a lot of people talk about, you know, oh, I moved to Atlanta for the parks. I moved to, you know, Montgomery County for the recreation facilities. You know, we have to provide that here as well. You know, I do hear those things, and we have to respond to that by saying, we're going to compete as well. We're going to give you the very same assets, world-class assets here that you could expect in other communities.
So how much is all this going to cost?
So the total plan is about a $14.5 million plan. And we've actually got some amendments that to the plan, a few things that we don't want to do. So you're going to see it come down to about $14 million total. What we have planned for is the first six phases. And our bicycle master plan is five phases, and we're planning for all five phases. So the first six phases of the Urban Greenway, all five phases of the bicycle master plan, everything that was in our phase one of the downtown master plan, which is the first 5 years, all of those things we intend to do in the next 5 years and are in the CIP going to the city council. And what's amazing is the overlap between them. And you start ticking off like, okay, well, this is what the bicycle master plan says we need to do. Well, it also says that in the Urban Greenway plan. It also said that in the downtown master plan. So that's not $1 million you need to spend in each. That's just $1 million. So take $2 million out of the plan. And the level of refinement in the cost estimation in the Urban Greenway plan has led us to focus on that as as the correct number through for budgeting purposes, for capital planning purposes. So we believe that those first six phases are going to cost us about $5.5 million and get us about 80% of the city's components of the plan.
So I guess the question becomes, for a lot of taxpayers, is do we have the money?
We better than have the money. The key to us is this: we have to plan in such a way that it's effective, that we achieve our vision, and that it's affordable. And so we are looking at spending less over the next 5 years than we've spent over the five previous, and including all of these things. So what it means is you're not going to see us building, you know, a new police station. You're not going to see us building more fire stations. You're not going to see us, buying a lot of fire equipment. You're going to see us invest a little less internally on the things that we've spent a lot of money on over the last 5 years.
Can we afford that?
Yeah, in fact...
To spend less? I mean, are we shortchanging one as opposed to the other?
We're not shortchanging. It's just that we did the buying that we needed to do for the coming decades on the front end of that. In fact, in about 5 years, we get to a place where we have to start buying some significant fire capital equipment again. What's great about our fire chief right now is that he's done a fantastic job planning the capital acquisition cycle. So our vehicle replacement plan for police and fire is detailed out to 20 years now. So we know exactly what we need to buy. So we know what we need to buy over the coming 5 years. We know what we need to buy over the next 10 years. We know what we need to buy over 20. The other piece of this is that the way the capital improvement planning process used to work is that it was a wish list. So you didn't know what the impact was going to be on your budget. If you were a council member, you could only guess what you were going to be able to afford 3 years from now. Today, our capital improvement plan, this capital improvement plan, which includes everything I just mentioned to you, is set up in such a way that it is exactly, precisely what we are going to be able to afford to do 3 years from now. Unless revenues get better, the economy gets better, then we're going to be able to do more. But we can afford everything, every dollar of what we're planning for right now.
Let me just briefly, a few minutes we have left.
Yeah.
How does all of this fit into the overall vision that you have for Salisbury? I sort of kind of mentioned that as it were. I mean, and I just talk about Route 13 and trying to figure out what to do about that. I mean, in 10 years, assuming that you're around or somebody else is around, they complete all these projects, is Salisbury going to look dramatically different?
Well, I don't plan on going anywhere, so I'm going to be around. I plan on being here, Don, so you can ask me in 10 years, but I think Salisbury's going to look dramatically different. This year, you're going to see a couple things. You're going to see, eventually this year, you're going to see our gateway signs go up. So I'm thinking about from working outside in. You've seen us achieve 62% more effectiveness in our 62% more code violations identified, 100% success in courts. So we're trying to clean up our neighborhoods. You've seen, we've got Tom Stevenson as the chief of operations at Public Works. There's nobody who's going to be out there ensuring the cleanliness of our streets, essentially ensuring that we are sweeping the lobby and the front mat, out front of our property. You've got to do those things. You got to do those things well. We've got the right person in that job right now. So I think you're going to see us take care of the assets we have, but working from the outside in. Gateway signs, our downtown signage, wayfinding system throughout the city, our wayfinding system for bikes and pedestrians will be implemented. And I'm thinking 10 years out, we'll have streetscape improvements on a variety of main corridors. So our new streetlight standard, our new bench standard, trash can recycling bin standard. You're going to see all of our parking meters, the single parking meters gone from downtown. You'll see we'll have the district meters, which is one per block, essentially. You'll see our parking garage is going to look entirely different on the outside. You're going to see the circle, the Riverside traffic circle. You're going to see this greenway completed in 10 years. You're going to see every single bike lane in the city that we want built out within those 10 years. Route 13, in 3 weeks, the city council gets our Route 13 corridor plan. Right. You're going to see the laws in place that say this is how we achieve a rebuilt Route 13. And this, it's through zoning. It's going to be through zoning. And it's going to say we demand more and better in that corridor.
We've been speaking with Mayor Jake Day, Mayor of Salisbury, with his plans for the city. Well, maybe we'll chat back in 10 years. We never know.
I hope we will.
Thanks for stopping by.
Of course. Thank you.
Also want to mention that we will be airing Mark Steiner's Annapolis Summit this afternoon at 1 p.m. on WSDL 90.7 FM, featuring Governor Larry Hogan, House Speaker Michael Bush, as well as Senate President Mike Miller. That's this afternoon at 1 p.m. on WSDL 90.7 FM. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC 14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit pac14.org.